The Pulse, weekdays from 5.
Because the BBC don't care about the beer prices in Mooch.
Good evening and welcome to The Pulse here on University Radio Nottingham, bringing you the news that matters to you on this Friday evening. My name's Joe Tanner. In the studio today I have Katie Rayburn, Harry Robertson and Amar Mehta. The stories we're going to be discussing today include Labour accusations of curbing winter fuel payments, Donald Trump and snails. But firstly, it's over to Amar, who's got a story on the David Ross Sports Village.
Earlier today, it was news came out that the David Ross Sports Village, which was opened in September, has been given the Olympic seal of approval. Alumni sports stars of the University of Nottingham have celebrated the official opening 10 months after the sports village was built. The 40 million village is a state-of-the-art facility on our campus and is an upgrade from the old sports village. Olympic table tennis champion Dr. Deng Yanping and gold medal-winning canoeist Tim Barton and Etienne Stott were among the sporting legends who were there for the opening. The Vice-Chancellor was quoted on the University of Nottingham website saying, "For David Ross's generous donations to support our Olympians, the scope and scale of alumni talent is clear. To be successful at anything takes drive, grit and determination and practice. Our alumni have been showcasing these attributes for many years, and I have followed their achievements with pride, knowing Nottingham may have laid the foundations for some of their successes. Today we celebrate a physical foundation, a complex of sporting facilities to be proud of, and one which will inspire the next generation of athletes." So what the first point I want to raise is, how come they've done the opening 10 months after the sports village was opened in September to students?
Well, I think that's the question that we're all kind of posing, isn't it, Amar? I mean, the fact that the sports village was due to be open at the start of this academic year and yet wasn't, I think was met with a lot of disapproval from a lot of students at the University of Nottingham who had paid their sports memberships and not received full access to the sports village from the start of the academic year, which makes it seem quite odd that this seal of approval and this official opening is happening now in May, 8-9 months after the sports village was due to be open. It just seems really odd, and it seems like students have been, I think, let down a bit there. Of course, the motive of this opening has been that, you know, it's a world-class facility, can really put the University of Nottingham on the map in terms of sport, not only in the East Midlands, but in the UK. And it's a great opportunity, of course, for alumni such as Etienne Stott, former Olympic medal winners, to come back to the University of Nottingham and introduce this new facility. But it's just a bit unjust and it's a bit unfair that this is happening now.
The university have this great phrase called phased introduction, which they use to describe any kind of slight blip or kind of things aren't going their way. So the student services centralisation, stuff like that, was a phased introduction. The David Ross Sports Village is a phased introduction. It basically just means they haven't got their act together and things haven't, you know, trust, you know, building work to take time. Yeah, that, I think that's reality. But also, on a more kind of serious note, with the whole organising in May, if you think about it, if you're trying to organise around alumni, vice-chancellors and stuff like that, picking a date must actually be pretty hard to get all those people together in the same room. So I do see why they've pushed it back. But yes, I completely agree with you on the point that for students who have wanted to access, you know, these facilities for the whole year and have paid for that, you know, haven't actually received that access. But I was wondering what you thought about the fact that the Vice-Chancellor's quote about saying that Nottingham laid some foundation in some of the alumni success. Do we think that's true? Do we think Nottingham actually had any bearing on these people? Or do they come back and kind of think, it's nice to get a pat on the back, but actually, this was mostly me, not you?
Yeah, I mean, certainly in terms of facilities, I mean, we were talking to Alison Mitchell, who's a BBC broadcaster on Test Match Special on BBC Radio 5 Live on Monday, and she was saying how completely different the facilities were from her time at the university in the 1990s and how it was pretty much not even like a grammar school or a private school kind of level of facilities. It was literally your bog standard gym and your bog standard sports hall, playing fields and not even AstroTurf. That was pretty much it. Whereas now, of course, they have this plethora of facilities in this new sports village, which lots of people now have access to, and of course will attract such talent from all over the world, being that we are a global university, not just in the UK. So yeah, I think it's a bit unfair that the university is taking some credit for the fact that these Olympians, you know, that we had some sort of a hand in their success. I think, yeah, it was very much down to their own endeavors.
I think it's optimistic and fine to say, oh, you know, in the future, these great facilities might serve, you know, to help other people go on to achieve sporting success. But yeah, I think maybe to start detracting from, you know, if we acknowledge what the facilities were like at the time that some of these Olympians were actually, or some of these alumni were actually studying here, I think that's a different kind of kettle of fish. But I was wondering as well, what kind of bearing the Davis Ross Sports Village will have in terms of our Bucks achievement? Will we start being able to rein in Loughborough, or is it still a while to go?
I think a long way off Loughborough at the moment. I mean, we're around about 1,500 Bucks points off of Loughborough, still in the Bucks rankings overall. But we're increasing, you know, gradually year by year. You know, 2 years ago, we were in seventh. We finished in the Bucks rankings overall. Last year, it was fourth. And this year, we look set on to finish third as well, just behind Durham, who themselves are very competent in all kind of sporting levels, not just the kind of team sports, which the University of Nottingham seems to pick up a lot of points in. Although now, with the growth of sports such as badminton, table tennis, of course, we're so renowned for at this university, the growth of the kind of individual, more sort of less mainstream team sports, if you like, are coming along a lot more. And that's due to this sports village and the range of facilities which is on offer, which enables people to put in their best and to kind of showcase their skill, and obviously to attract such a great plethora of talent. I mean, I've got an example, you know, Li Lian Yang, who's a badminton player from Malaysia. She won Bucks gold at the Bucks Nationals back in February. So integral to the badminton league success. Of course, like, that's another factor. We've got so many elite leagues and elite teams in various sports across the university, and that's having a massive effect upon the university's reputation as a global, not just a UK sporting institution, which is attracting so much talent and it's bringing so much to the university. But I just wanted to, I think you picked up on this before the show, Harry, this kind of aspect of cost and students not getting value for money, sort of combined with something that Beth Massey, one of the SU officers, said recently on Facebook. She said that she's been aware of the ridiculous prices, she quotes, ridiculous prices placed on graduation, robe hire costs and guest tickets, and the live stream here at the university has lobbied this year to reduce them. So there clearly is, on that basis, there is a sense that the students are, you know, there might be this sort of sense of a gap between the administrative bodies and the university students, not just in a sporting terms, but, you know, across other areas as well.
Yeah, definitely. There's this conflicting idea and philosophy, really, between the two bodies, which is, you know, the university is kind of runs more on a business model, on trying to actually, you know, it's thinking about costs, it's thinking about profit, and it's thinking about being a player on kind of the world stage, as it were, and it is part of other groups of universities that are looking to do the same. And then you have the far more kind of local representation and interest of the students' union, which, you know, as Beth Massey is trying to do, is trying to represent students. And that stems from the fact of just one student posting saying, you know, all these fees are ridiculous. You know, was it a gown for £50 to hire, and then we've got tickets for a live stream event that costs like £12, and people are saying, why isn't a live stream just free? And apparently you have to pay for, you know, the buffet that accompanies it and stuff like that. And it's just kind of it seems like every opportunity, you know, will be to try and maximize profit, and it's a little bit disheartening. But I think we might be fairly unique amongst universities, the relationship between RSU and the university, in that it's actually more of a partnership I think our relationship with the university actually enables us to get a lot more done from a position of being more cooperative with them than it does with actually being antagonistic to them. And I think the SU, our current SU at least, knows when to apply the pressure and knows when to it's best to kind of work along and try and acknowledge that, you know, we're lobbying but we might not see the effects for a while. And unfortunately, that's the reality of the way student politics works. And I'm sure that we'll see, we're already seeing the benefits from previous years' lobbying. You know, you can go, you know, the meal cards at Mooch and all this kind of stuff has been in the works for a while. And hopefully we will see action on graduation fees, because it is hard for students to shell out all this money for graduation. You know, the classic argument of I'm paying, you know, 27 grand, 36 grand for having to dish out more money. But you know, I think if you read Beth Massey's post, it will hopefully clear up any confusion, and it will make it clear that you are being represented and your views are being heard. Unfortunately, there is a process involved, and there are kind of wider ramifications to think about. And I will say there was one thing that I took issue with from the university's response, and it was pointed out by someone else as well, which was about the university saying that if they don't make money here, then they can, well, basically the line of argument was, if we don't make money here, we might have to cut elsewhere. When you're making a profit of millions of pounds, you kind of think, no, you don't. You don't have to do that. But you know, that's it was. I felt it was a bit of a veiled threat. That might just be me and my interpretation of their statement. But that's how I felt that.
Yeah, I think we've discussed price and costs at our university quite a lot this year, with the Price of Sport special, which you can find online. And I think it's a hot topic, which is a lot of students care about, because obviously, shelling out over almost close to £100 to get your diploma after you've paid almost close to 40 grand when you take into consideration the maintenance loans and stuff, it's a lot of money to shell out for something which is expected to be given to you almost for free. Obviously I understand you have the cost of the gown and stuff, but when I saw the comment on Beth's post on Facebook about charging for a live stream, I just thought that was silly, and I don't understand how the university can charge so much to watch something on TV when they're shelling out millions of pounds for a chessboard and a big screen outside Portland. I think the universities see students as customers rather than helping us with our futures.
You're listening to The Pulse, URN's award-winning news show, where it's all about the news that matters to you.
Welcome back to The Pulse here on University Radio Nottingham, bringing you the news that matters to you. Well, now, we've had stories on the David Ross Sports Village and the recent FBI scandal and the Trump presidency. And now we're going to move on to a story about Labour saying the curbs on winter fuel payments are sick and sneaky. So Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell said 10 million people would be hit by Tory proposals to means test the allowance. Labour, which says it will retain universal payments if it wins power, had suggested that axing them increases the risking of people dying this winter. The Tories say help will go to those most in need, but there is opposition to the policy from the party in Scotland. After the launch of her party's own manifesto, Scottish Conservative leader Ruth Davidson told Sky News that she wants to keep universal payments in Scotland, and under the terms of the 2016 Scotland Act, devolution allows me to do so, according to Davidson. The SNP, which is in government in Scotland, said limiting help to the poorest was just plain wrong, and it was right to give pensioners who've contributed all of their lives a little bit of extra help during the cold winter months. At the moment, households automatically receive a single payment ranging from £100 to £300 each December if there is one person living there who has reached the qualifying age and who meets the other criteria. Around 12.26 million people received the tax-free allowance in 2015 and 2016 at a total cost of just over £2 billion. Under plans in the Conservative manifesto, eligibility would be related to income, although the party has not indicated what the threshold would be and who would qualify for it. But McDonnell told the BBC that the scale of the money that the Conservatives hope to raise, which he said was in the region of £1.5 billion each year, suggested all those who did not qualify for the pension credit could lose their allowances, hitting millions of those on low and middle incomes. So, guys, what do we think of this recent statement by the Labour Party on the curbing of winter allowances? Do we think that this is fair for people? I mean, there seems to be a growing sort of theme of many kind of election trails and, you know, the campaigning of this kind of mudslinging towards one another's policies, especially on tax, it would seem, with it being such a such a point of contention for both the Labour and the Conservative Party. Amar, what do you think about the topic?
I think it's pretty bad for the Conservatives to be cutting winter fuel payments, because a lot of these old people are fragile, can't always afford heating, and I think the government needs to do as much as they can to support the elderly, because they're the ones who laid the foundations for the society we live in today. They fought in wars for our freedoms, and I think cutting their winter fuel payments, I don't think it'll make much difference to how much money the government actually makes overall. And I think there's other areas which can be looked at to make money rather than cutting the heating bills for old people. I think if maybe they've focused on catching tax evaders and tax avoiders, they'd make, I think I read somewhere it was almost £4.3 billion from that. So if they're focused and focus their attention on that rather than victimising and marginalising the elderly from society, then they might have be able to do better.
Also, I think that the problem is that if you do start doing things like cutting winter fuel allowance for people who are already frail and who actually do already, sounds bad, but do already cost a lot, because in terms of like the NHS and things, all it does is run up costs in the NHS and areas where they actually, if they get ill or if they're already ill and they can't afford heating, like it's just going to make them ill. I also think that in terms of if they're making cuts, I think it's probably, agree with Amar, it's not something that you should be focusing on, particularly as now Labour coming out with all these claims that they're going to get rid of tuition fees by cutting things like corporation tax. I'm not saying that it's that reasonable, but it is quite popular with a lot of people. So I think that sort of putting forward a policy that damages the lives of frail people. So I think that actually they should be targeting people like corporations who actually already have a lot of money and should be taxed more.
We've actually just had a text in which reads from Sarah, if they wasted less on the military, then this wouldn't be an issue. I mean, there is this sense of gaining money and gaining money through tax from other areas of government, all kinds of areas, as we mentioned, corporation tax and tax avoidance as well. Harry, what do you think of the issue on the fuel payments?
Well, I think Sarah raised a good point about military spending. And I think obviously what I assume Sarah's referring to is the Trident budget, which we still commit billions of pounds to, despite the fact that it's been pointed out by various people that the current Trident program that we have isn't actually sufficient enough to deter a nuclear threat, and wouldn't be able. We have no like anti-ballistic system that would be able to intercept a nuclear missile if it was launched our way. And seeing as we're part of various treaties that prohibit kind of firing nuclear weapons and stuff like that, and we haven't got a kind of perceived threat in any way, you know, you're looking at all this investment and thinking, where is it going? Obviously, the argument against that is about kind of the technology and the high industry jobs that it creates around nuclear. But then you could kind of argue, well, why not push those jobs towards the energy sector, where actually we could work on nuclear fuel and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, it's a strange move from the Conservatives in terms of cutting, in terms of these cuts, because the, you know, traditionally kind of the 65 plus bracket are a conservative demographic. You know, they're a key group that the Conservatives often, you know, target with policies and stuff, whereas Labour do tend to, you know, focus more of their policies towards young people. So it's kind of it confuses me that they're trying to blindside one of their key demographics this way, when normally they're kind of quite a bankable insurance in an election, and especially obviously so close to an election now. But I don't know, maybe they think, you know, this is the way it works, and obviously they know that the austerity model is attractive to certain people in terms of it kind of gives off this appearance of fiscal responsibility and stuff like that. Fiscal responsibility is for some reason associated with the Conservatives, and yet they were 30 of their constituencies were investigated for election misspending. So that's not very fiscally responsible. And in the same way, we're talking, Abby brought up earlier in terms of corporation tax and stuff like that, where are we going to get this money from? You just have to look at banking bonuses and putting a cap on them, or at least taxing them in some way, because what we had was either 2016 or 2015, the leader of Barclays Bank, in a year in which he termed his performance as unacceptable, he raked in a bonus of £17 million. That was his bonus, not even his salary. And yet we're thinking that somehow trickle-down economics still works when actually there's people going to food banks.
Well, you draw on a couple of very interesting points there, Harry. Firstly, the fact that it is kind of peculiar that this policy has been implemented on the basis of the elderly people, the over 50s, being a key demographic for Conservative votes in the upcoming election. And they've kind of, with this move, I think, reaffirmed their reputation as the nasty party in British politics. I mean, how on earth can Theresa May justify decreasing corporate tax and those at the top when the public sector is being cut by £16 billion every single year? It's honestly atrocious. Absolutely atrocious, and it's disgusting on so many levels in terms of social care, healthcare, and all the rest of it when relating to a number of their policies. And they always sort of rattle off and kind of rebuff these situations by the fact that employment has gone up in various factors, especially the NHS. They always love to put that one out there, especially when in terms of nurses and the amount of people employed. But then people are going to food banks, they're having 18-hour shifts every day in the hospital.
With these statistics and these brackets of employment and poverty levels, people forget that it's the government who sets those brackets. They can determine what is employable and what is, what's a poverty level. And between, I think it was like 1980 and 1991, so basically when the Conservatives were in power, the employment, the poverty line was changed 16 times in order to make their numbers look better. Various governments do it all the time to point the statistics their way. But it just means if they try and sell you an easy statistic about, whether it's, immigrants taking jobs or employment levels, make sure to check that actually it's not them feeding you a statistic that they've carefully kind of brochured and selected for you to digest.
Mm. And also just kind of drawing upon that, Theresa May's sort of said a lot about the Labour manifesto and how there's this argument that costs don't add up at all. Well, of course they do. It's the most transparent manifesto that we've seen in many, many an election campaign. But
I think they've allowed for like £4 billion of money just in case to make sure that if spending goes up or if they actually have more money, there's a £4 billion net difference between what they're spending and what they'll be taxing and stuff.
Just quickly touching on what you were saying, Joe, a bit earlier. I think you're absolutely right in saying that, they're cutting in the wrong sectors, in the most important sectors of society. We've got health. We've had these plans for a long, long time to be making cuts to the NHS. And this has been spanning over the last year or so. And it is outrageous that, this is a very important and a huge place where money needs to be, I think, invested rather than being made cuts to. So that's first of all with the fuel cuts, that's obviously going to affect the demographics of like the elderly. But we've also got, things at the moment, like with interest being charged now on university fees. And that's going to cause like a huge uproar with students. So it's going to be it's going to be interesting in the next couple of weeks, seeing, it's affecting a lot of age range, young and old.
This is URN.